Do you remember at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, the big push to keep us safe involved social distancing and hand washing? But there was very little, if any, talk about the airborne spread of the virus, even from organisations like the World Health Organization, or WHO.
Reading statements from the WHO stating that the virus is not airborne. And then I thought, well, this is beyond anything I could tolerate any longer. Something has to be done immediately about this.
That's QUT Distinguished Professor Lydia Morovska, one of the first people in the world to ring the alarm bells last year about the airborne transmission of COVID. But she faced a surprisingly uphill fight to get her initial research on this published.
At first, it was difficult to publish any of these papers. The first two papers, that open letter published in CAD, was first rejected by Nature, was rejected by Lancet.
But now her research on the airborne spread of COVID is among the most cited in the world. Now she's taking on a different fight.
Something which we must be doing, and that's the call for a paradigm shift in how we operate, basically.
Lydia says we essentially need a ventilation revolution, that we must change how we circulate the air in the buildings where we work and in our homes.
If we were to be infected, let's say drinking tap water, which is contaminated, well, that would be a very big outcry. We wouldn't tolerate this. But for some reason, we tolerate without questioning polluted, contaminated indoor air, because that's basically what it is.
Lydia is director of the International Laboratory for Air Quality and Health at QUT, and one of the world's foremost experts on aerosol science. The Australian Academy of Science elected her as a fellow in 2020. In 2018, she received the Eureka Prize for Infectious Diseases Research. QUT Distinguished Professor Lydia Morovska, our guest this week on The Random Sample. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily Duane. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics and the people involved. You can learn more about what the centre does by visiting our website, acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host for this episode is ASEM's Deputy Director, Kerry Mengerson, a Distinguished Professor of Statistics at QUT.
Hi, Lydia. Well, thanks very much for joining us and thanks for speaking on The Random Sample. You've really become a world leader in raising awareness about airborne spread of COVID-19. And before we get to that, though, what were you doing pre-COVID-19?
Well, this is a very big question. I was doing lots of different things with the main focus over the past almost 30 years on airborne particulate matter. Particles in the air are from many different sources, from anthropogenic sources like cars, combustion, natural sources, volcanic emissions and so on. But they are also particles from our respiratory activities. When we breathe, when we speak, we emit particles. So this was the whole world of particles I was investigated before COVID, and of course anything else related to this, because particles are never in the air on their own. They are always gaseous pollutants as well.
So you have a centre here, the WHO Centre for Air Quality and Health. Would you like to talk a little about that?
Yes, this is a WHO collaborating centre for air quality and health, and this centre is now in its third term. And we've been working very closely with WHO on a range of topics, of course, related to air quality, and participating in many activities of the WHO, in particular developing new guideline documents, but also working with developing countries on issues related to air quality.
So what brought you into this area, and what made you want to go into this area of research?
Well, it was SARS-1. During SARS-1, I was invited, in fact, by the WHO to join a team of researchers in Hong Kong to to investigate the mystery of the outbreak in the Amoy Gardens complex of apartment buildings. Over 300 people were infected from one person who spent there one night. And there was a team of epidemiologists who couldn't get to the bottom of what happened. So WHO was putting together a team of aerosol experts. And I must say that I was dreading the idea of going to Hong Kong at that time. Luckily, I didn't have to go because by that stage the outbreak was over and the WHO thought that there was not enough evidence on the ground. But then I started looking into this topic, and as I mentioned before, the subparticles from human expiratory activities. So I realized how little research was done by that stage on the physics of emissions or exhalation of these particles. So I thought, well, this is so interesting scientifically, but also so extremely important. I've applied for ASC grants. We got a grant and we did studies which are now conducted, some kind of fundamental studies in this topic. But then I wanted to apply these learnings into prevention or control of airborne transmission in buildings, because this is the next logical step. And there I found out that this wasn't easy. No one was interested in this. By that stage, SARS-1 was a distant memory. So in general, infection transmission was of little interest to anybody, including granting bodies. But also I found that there were strange pushbacks in terms of comments from ARC assessors that the airborne transmission is not possible. I was thinking, how come anybody can say anything like this? Little I knew then how big pushbacks existed within that community. But because of this, over the years, while we've done quite a lot of work on various aspects of this, we were not able to go full speed as we would have liked into investigating control measures of infection transmission in buildings.
Yeah, well, you've certainly taught me a lot about airborne particles over the time. But I'd like to go back to early 2020 and to the outbreak of COVID. And we knew then very little about the spread of this virus, and the initial measures really called for social distancing and hand washing. But there wasn't really anything known about the airborne spread of the virus. And why do you think that was?
Well, not wasn't much known about this virus, because obviously this virus was a new virus. But on the other hand, this is just a respiratory virus, and there is a huge body of knowledge about respiratory viruses as such. So expecting that it wouldn't be transmitted through the air was illogical, I would say. So what brought me to this very early in the pandemic were actually two specific moments of this. One was I was sitting at the airport in Frankfurt when I got an email from a colleague of mine in China, Junji Cao, quite concerned that the Chinese authorities at the time were not considering airborne transmission. And he wanted us to do something, to publish something on this topic. So on the flight to Japan, where I was going, my last international travel, I was working on the paper, which eventually became the one of the most cited papers of the Journal of Environmental International on the topic airborne transmission of COVID-19, the way the world should face the reality. So this was the first moment and realization that really something needs to be done. But the second was about a month later, at the end of March, reading statements from the WHO stating that the virus is not airborne. And then I thought, well, this is beyond anything I could tolerate any longer. Something has to be done immediately about this, because it will be a huge problem in the world if that's how this is viewed. So that was the step when I decided to take big action.
Well, we're fortunate that you did, and it certainly caused a big change in the way people think. You talk about the paper that you published, and there was the commentary in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases, and a number of other commentaries that you published and have been, and as you say, have been widely cited. But how have they been received? Has there been like just all positive citations, or has there been some great debate about this? What's been the general reception?
Well, the first, it was difficult to publish any of these papers, apart maybe from the last, the science paper, went relatively smoothly, and the editors were interested in this. The first two papers, that open letter published in CAD, was first rejected by Nature, was rejected by Lancet. In a way, it was censored. That's what we've expressed to the editors, and it was only then when the CAD, which has a very open mind about this, realized that this is an important topic. So this is one aspect how we publish the papers. But then, after we published them, particularly the open letter, I received basically thousands, if not tens of thousands, of emails from around the world, from people from any walks of life in terms of background, scientists, medical experts, engineers, architects, just name it. There wasn't a single email which I received which would question airborne transmission. All the emails were extremely supportive and thanking us for taking this. So this for me, this was quite amazing, because while I expected that scientists would understand this and would have a very similar view, likewise engineers, but the question was how medical community would react to this, knowing that the pushbacks were from the medical community. There was not a single email from anybody from medical community questioning this. So this made me think, how is it possible that it is such a support from medical community, yet we are not able at that stage, and well, to an extent still now, to get this into the public health legislation?
Yeah, well, that's pretty compelling. So you had all of this support, and then you really had to take on WHO. So how did that go?
Well, this was the first step to take the WHO, and then thinking how to do, which step to take, was actually as a result of a conversation with a colleague of mine from Italy. It was also at the end of March last year. He was very preoccupied at the time with the level of transmission in Italy and the extraordinary number of deaths. So his worry was that, after all, many of the people infected and dying are medical professionals. And he said that he knew many of them, and they all do things by the book in terms of infection prevention. But then one element which wasn't in the book was the issue of airborne transmission, ventilation, and all these aspects. So he suggested, let's write to the Italian authorities and make them aware of this and ask them to do something. And then I was thinking about this, and from what my understanding of the interaction with public health authority was, I thought they would ignore two lone scientists, despite our, well, as being well known in the field. They were not going to do anything. And then I thought we needed to start from the top, which is from the WHO. And that's what we did. Within basically 3 days, I organized what's now called a group of 36 and directly approached the WHO. Unfortunately, WHO was not really receptive to doing much about this, and therefore was that open letter, which was to the WHO and public health authorities, after which, the day after the paper was published, the WHO for the first time acknowledged the possibility of the virus being airborne. And then since then, they've been gradually, slowly changing the wording. But this was quite a process.
So take us through the last 12 months. What has changed in the understanding of the airborne spread of COVID?
I'd say that in terms of the general principles of infection transmission, there isn't really much new. because we had a really reasonably good understanding of respiratory particles from respiratory activities, of the content of virus. Of course, it varies. It depends on the specific virus and of all kinds of other factors. But the general principles were there. So, of course, then there is a knowledge about this specific virus. So, like any specific virus, is the question, what is the emitted quanta, which means the number of virus-latent particles which will infect 63% of susceptible people, Poisson's distribution. This is normally not, well, it's not known for any virus a priori, so that's something which had to be found. It also varies between the different variants. So the same question we are asking now about the Delta. So these are the specifics of this virus. There's also a whole issue of the aspects related to virology, which I'm not talking about, and the virology and the interaction of this virus with the cells. This is something quite extraordinary from my reading about this, but as I said, this is not my expertise. But talking about the virus transmission in the air, well, we now know more in terms of quantitative factors about this virus, but nothing has really changed in terms of the principles of its transmission.
So, Lydia, for the general public, then there's quite a big difference between the different variants, and people are concerned now about the Delta variant, for example. So, how does that change with respect to the airborne spread of the disease? Is like, what's different between the different variants?
What's the difference is the amount of virus emitted. So in terms of the principles of airborne transmission, nothing much changes, but it is how much of it it's emitted. And Delta, the variant Delta, there's much more of it emitted. But to that point, if you compare the emission of other between viruses, for example, if you look at tuberculosis, rhinovirus, and so on, the emission of each virus is different. So the fact that there are different emissions, this is not something unusual and not something which changes the principle of transmission. So the same with this virus, that Delta variant means more emissions, which means that shorter exposure time will result with infection compared to others. But as I said, the principles of its transport in the air, inhalation, deposition in the lung is the same.
Okay. So we now know what we know, thanks to you, and many other people. So the obvious next challenge then is how do we change the indoor spaces where we work and live? And in your mind, it's not just a matter of something we should be doing, but something we must be doing, right?
Something which we must be doing, and that's the call for the paradigm shift in how we operate, basically. The first aspect of this is not that much science as a starting point, is just accepting that this is an important area. Before the pandemic, no one really worried too much about having infectious colleagues, people, friends around. Somebody would come to work coughing and sneezing, and we would shrug our shoulders. Okay, well, that's how it is. And no one would think, okay, 3 days later I'll be infected as well. Is there anything we could do about this? No one would dare challenging the colleagues, why did you come with being infected? So it is awareness, and more than awareness is the mindset that this is not, it shouldn't be like this. If we were to be infected, let's say drinking tap water, which is contaminated, well, that would be a very big outcry. We wouldn't tolerate this. But for some reason, we tolerate without questioning polluted, contaminated indoor air, because that's basically what it is. So first element of this is to change in our mindset, not accepting polluted indoor air, and realizing that we often are part of being the problem as well. So if we are infected, we are the problem, then we need to do something in terms of not coming to work, wearing masks or something, not doing. So that's the first aspect, but there's also only as far as individual responsibility in this goes. There's a big role to play by public health authorities to mandate clean indoor air, and part of this is prevention of or minimization of infection transmission. The problem here, however, is that the complexity of this going between many different areas of the government departments. So public health is within the Department of Health, but then the Department of Health is not taking care of our buildings. So some other departments are involved in this, and a number of them, for example, when we are talking about schools, is Department of Education. So there's lots of players, and if there are lots of players, there's always difficult to get them to work together to come up with, say, legislation which will protect us in all type of indoor environments. So this is one starting challenge. But then once this is somehow overcome, then we are going to the science and technology, how to deal with this, after all, an extremely complex system, to take all the elements of this system together, to work together. It's not that we don't know anything about this element. We have individual elements of the building, of the ventilation system, of SSSRs, but putting it together such that it works and protects us, this is the novelty and the challenge.
Thanks. So there's a social element. There's a social agency about not coming to work if you're ill or infectious, and there's about being able to like tell others if they're infectious, and that goes, I guess, for colds and flus and more than just COVID. So there's that social aspect, and then there's the building aspect, and there's also a cost aspect, and there's a communication across government aspect, and as you say, it's extremely complex. And I guess what you're doing really is setting that up not just for COVID but also for other viruses, colds and flus in general. So this is something that you're doing for the future as well as for now.
This is exactly the case. That's what I'm stating. We are not working basically for COVID much more, because by the time all this will be set in operation in terms of new designs, new ways we operate the buildings, hopefully COVID will be over. But COVID is not the last pandemic. There will be more pandemics in the future. And every year we have epidemics of seasonal flu, of colds, or many other respiratory infections, which are extremely costly. We don't realize how much they cost. In Australia, the cost of influenza and other respiratory infections is assessed up to about $150 million a year. And these are just the cost, medical cost. In this is not included the other cost, like lost productivity, absenteeism, and so on. So it is extremely costly.
Lydia, what needs to change in a building then? When you say that we need changes in the building, in the air conditioning, what is it that needs to change?
The principle is ventilation. This is really the starting point. And ventilation has two important aspects, sufficient and effective ventilation. Sufficient means enough of it to remove the virus from the air. Now, enough of it in relation to infection transmission. Of course, there are existing building ventilation codes, the prescribed ventilation levels, air exchange rates, and so on, for example, in relation to carbon dioxide, which we all exhale. Not that carbon dioxide is included as an air pollutant, because at the level we have them in indoor environments, not pollutant yet, but it's more a proxy for ventilation. So this exists already. But the fact, for example, that carbon dioxide is at an acceptable level, it doesn't mean that infection transmission is also at an acceptable level as well. There are different ways of calculating what's acceptable level, and here we are going with risk assessment models. So this has to be taken on board in terms of assessing what's the level of sufficient ventilation in relation to COVID and in relation to other respiratory infections, which will have different emitted and infectious quanta. But the second aspect is efficient ventilation, which means everywhere within the indoor space, not leaving dead corners, for example, and not creating situations of unidirectional flow, like from one person to another. Let's say it's is flowing from the top, going to one person, and then directly to the other person. And if the people spend enough time together in this environment, therefore there could be enough opportunity for the susceptible person to inhale this. So these are the very simple concepts, but there's an infinite number of ways air can flow in different in any different type of indoor environment. It could be by design, would be flowing one way, but it's enough that, let's say, you put some barriers or something, open the door and keep it open while it was accepted that it be closed, and air flows in a different way. So we can't really easily visualize that airflow. We can't feel it, which way it is flowing. So creating systems in which we would be able to somehow influence appropriate this airflow such that it never flows from one person to another, this is very important.
That sounds very challenging and but really, really useful. I guess from our perspective then, this is a maths and stats centre of excellence, and from a statistician's perspective especially, you know, what I hear in all of what you've been saying is data and models and maths and predictions and so on. So would you like to talk a little bit about, from a data standpoint or from a maths and stats standpoint, where do maths and stats play a role in what you've been doing, and what can we do to support the kind of work that you're doing?
Well, it will be if we are to progress with this field, maths and stats will be really critical. If I compare the situation of indoor environment to the outdoor environment, of course, outdoor environment is complex, and because of this, there are many different models of airflow outdoors and the distribution of pollutants outdoors. But then, let's say around in Queensland, there's one airshed for Queensland. Now, in relation to indoor environments, there are individual airshed, indoor air, in each individual building, in each individual room. So there is a very, very large number of these different environments. We can model airshed for Brisbane, but we can't model every indoor environment in every building. So there's a big problem how we'll generalize from investigations or modeling for certain number of indoor environments to the whole building stock and to the designs for the future. This is one of the biggest problems, and particularly in relation to this effective ventilation in terms of airflow. We have risk assessment models which existed long time before this pandemic, and which we've used to take into account air exchange rate, which is ventilation in a room, taking into account specifics of different pathogens, and here I'm talking not only about viruses but also bacteria like tuberculosis, and the assuming uniform distribution, and then dependently on the time spent to calculate the infection risks. So this is straightforward. During the course of the pandemic, such models mushroomed. There are many developers of such models, and this is now being accepted, it's the beginning of being accepted to use as tools for risk assessment in buildings. for example, the Italian public health authorities took the basis which we laid for this in our recent papers for school, for schools, and included this in the recommendations how to do risk assessment. But what we would like in the future to have this kind of semi-automatic systems that for a specific setting we would be able, based on the parameters of the settings, based on the knowledge or assumed or predicted infectious quanta and activities conducted in that building, and this then means our respiratory activities, whether we are silent there, whether we speaking or singing, and generate sufficient number of simulations and modeling to come some general view or vision of how to design interiors or where what works, what doesn't work. There's no other way really here, as much as it may sound not scientific doing lots of simulations, but that's what it would have to be done.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I guess that combination of the models and the simulations and also a lot of the sensor information that we have now and sensor data in buildings. And so I can see it can be an exciting time for the maths and stats communities to rise to the occasion and to support the kind of work that you're doing. But I guess this is not just about maths and stats and even physics and aerosol science. It's also about communication. So I guess that there's a lot to be said about how we talk about or how we communicate to the public about the virus and how it spreads and what's important and the kinds of work that you're doing and kinds of changes that you're trying to make. Would you like to talk a little bit about the role of communication?
The role of communication is absolutely critical in this, because we may have all the science, all the technology, all the math available, but if this science is rejected, nothing's going to happen. In a way, we have if I can compare it with the situation relating to science of climate change. We have the science behind this. There's no doubt about the science, yet it's not necessarily accepted by the whole community, even so it's being more and more accepted, and it's certainly not accepted by politicians because of all kinds of other agendas and vested interest. So on the one hand is having science, but on the other hand is to using the science. And the role of awareness, which is communication, and particularly in relation to infection transmission, awareness by the whole community of the problem, and also realization that something can be done about this, that we don't have to live with this. This is absolutely critical, because if this is not accepting, nothing is going to happen about our science. It will be lots of papers which wouldn't be doing anything.
Well, thank you so much for this. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for talking to the Random Sample today.
My pleasure to be on the program.
If you're interested in finding out more, we have links to some of Professor Morawska's research as well as some news stories about her and her work. Just head to the ASIMS webpage for this episode. Go to asims.org.au/podcast and click on episode 58. Thank you for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes, because we think stories about maths and stats are worth sharing, and we want others to discover that as well. You can learn more about what we do at asims.org.au. That's acems.org.au. And you can find us on social media by searching at acemathstats. That's at acemathstats. We'll see you next week with another story from within ASIMS. Bye for now.